Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. Today's guest is a contemporary romance author who sometimes sets her books in South Africa, which is where she lives, which I'm very excited about talking about because we kind of started about it before we started. But please welcome Therese Bahari.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming and setting this all up. We had like the time zone, because it's a pretty significant time difference, and it was like the time zone shuffle. Like, okay, wait, this time here, then how many hours is that?
It was so strange because of the daylight savings thing.
Yes, and in the middle, we had daylight savings.
Exactly.
The so you and I had the time.
We had the time set, and then
right, we're like, okay, we're set. And then it was like, oh wait, now it's all different. Let's start over.
Exactly. And I mean, I've published in the US and in the UK, so it's like.
You're always a shuffle.
Yeah, exactly. And my publisher is in a different time zone in the US as my agent. So I'm like always just like figuring out, like Googling time zone.
Right. What time is it? What is it?
Current time in, and then wherever it is. So I'm used to doing it. It's completely
anytime
fine. I'm
that it's not like it's, I don't know why. It's like my brain doesn't work when it switched. So like if it's like 7 o'clock in the United States and it's noon in, you know, the UK or something, then I'm fine. But if it's like 7 and then it's back around and it's to the 3, I'm like, oh my god, now it's too much. Like my brain just goes, no thank you.
Another one of those things is whenever someone says to me, oh, it'll be out in the summer or springtime, and I'm like, our seasons do not work the same.
Awful,
so I do not know what you're talking about. Exactly.
We're so, I think especially, I don't know, maybe it's not true. Maybe it isn't, especially in this country, although I will blame us because we're the worst. But like we just don't have that sense, like that the world isn't on our schedule. You know, I mean, because it's true. I've had several Australian authors also, which is a significant time difference, and also an opposite seasonal situation. Yes. It's like, how's your summer going? They're like, yeah, no, it is winter here. Right.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I'm usually I have some Australian friends, and it's actually so refreshing. Actually, speaking with the UK as well, because we have a 2-hour time difference or 1-hour time difference, depending on where in the year they are. So whenever I have that, I'm like, oh no, I can do that. And then someone will be like, oh, we're going live on Instagram, Eastern Standard Time. And then I check and it's like midnight here. I was like, okay, I can't make that. Sorry.
Yeah, I wonder. And I mean, we sort of started mentioning this before we started recording, so we can just jump into it. But I mean, being an author in South Africa and you're publishing in the UK and in the UK system, in the United States system, how much does that affect you, you know, that we are sort of hemisphere blind and time zone blind, as far as, because I was thinking about this morning, that like, for me, it's like, it's no big deal because we're not live, we're recording this and I'm going to edit it and it's fine. And so it's like, and I'm very flexible with my time, but because you know, we do a lot of, here's a promo thing where you can be on this panel and it's live, or you're on Instagram live.
Yeah.
And if it's 3 a.m. for you, you're either going to have to get up at 2 a.m. and get dressed and put makeup.
Exactly.
Or you're going to have to say no.
Yeah. Well, at this stage, I mean, up to this point, I've actually said no quite a lot.
Yeah.
So, and to be honest with you, I haven't really been asked that much, because having primarily done category romances, that was very UK based. And it's also, you know, there's obviously a lot more authors that they can choose from. So if they, you know, are looking for someone in my line that I write for, or with my background, they can just go to someone else and be like, okay, you know, this person can't make it. So it means that you are often standing sort of outside of a lot of promo opportunities. And all you have to sort of do cartwheels and try and figure out, okay, right now, I mean, I told you I just put my kids to bed, but I actually just fed them, and then I told my husband, okay, you do the rest, and then I'm coming to come do this, because this is like the only time I have, the only gap I have.
Right.
I'm, you know, in the evening and juggling balls and all of that. So, but I've been lucky that I've worked with a lot of people like you, who are flexible or more, you know, willing to actually make those accommodations. But in terms of purely business, it's been very challenging.
Yeah. And I would think that the same thing holds true, what we were just kind of joking about with the time zones with an agent or an editor, that you don't necessarily, do you get as much FaceTime, I guess, you know, like being able to talk on the phone if you want to talk through something or if you need to, like.
No. So I don't think in terms of my editors, my relationship with my editors, it's very rarely that I will ask for a phone call. I think that's also partly because I have anxiety. So a lot of the times, you know, I have to kind of weigh up, is this, you know, as confusing as the stress will be to actually have this phone call? And really, really, is it?
Right. So, can we have this stress over email and resolve this in that way and not have a call?
That's exactly how I sort of measured it. Well, I'll tell myself, okay, I can formulate my response better in email. So I'll sit with it for a day and then I'll be able to do that. Things are a lot different with my agent. I feel a lot more comfortable speaking with her, right? So I am not nervous. I don't know why. I'm not as nervous. I'm still nervous, but I'm not as nervous doing that because I think we have to be honest. So I can say things and I don't, you know, I'm not worried about how is she going to interpret this. Is my intention coming across as well as, you know, I'd like it to. So that's been a lot easier. And she's been really wonderful as well in terms of saying, okay, you know, let's meet 7 o'clock, you know.
Right, being more flexible about the time.
Exactly. It'll be like 8 o'clock her time, which, I mean, sometimes she's, I'm like, I know, I'm so sorry, it's early. And she's like, it's fine. But I have had editors who are also willing to do that. So sometimes I'm sitting and it's like pitch dark. We're doing a Skype thing and it's pitch dark that side.
Right.
And it's so bright here, or vice versa. So yeah, it's a juggling act.
Well, and it must add an extra layer because I think most of us, you know, have that. An agent relationship does tend to be a little more, I don't know, friendly. That sounds like an editor relationship isn't friendly. Mm-hmm. That isn't what I mean. But like, you know, I mean, you have a very different relationship because you're really on the same team, you know, and in a different way than you're on the same team with an editor. So, I mean, yeah, I can imagine that, like, then adding in that layer of, and also we have to figure out time zones.
Exactly. And the thing is with an editor, you, I mean, I've worked with several editors over my career. And I mean, I haven't been around pretty long. I think this is my 6th year, but I think I've had probably about 6 editors that I've worked with. So
that's a revolving door.
Exactly. And you never know when it's going to change. You have to be adaptable, but it means you're constantly establishing new relationships and you constantly have to, you know, figure out what that person's personality is and how their approach to your writing is going to be.
And if they're going to like your writing, that was always the stressful part for me. It's like, this person loves my writing and is willing to like go to bat.
Yeah.
And the next person's like, yeah, she's fine. I'm like, wait, what? No, I had a moment. Let me have my moment back.
Exactly like that. Or your strategies or your approaches are completely different.
Exactly.
You know, where the focus is on something that you maybe don't think about or care about. Like I am not a descriptive writer. Well, I don't feel like I'm a descriptive writer, just in terms of, like, you know, you get those authors who, when you go into a room, they describe everything beautifully and that sense of place is there. That is not me. So mine is much more emotion driven and emotional. So when I always have to go back and be like, okay, you know,
what are they wearing?
Exactly.
What do these people even look like? Yeah, I do the same thing. I'm much more like, I'll drive those emotions in. And then later I'm like, did I ever describe what he looked like? Like, I know what he looks like.
Yes, exactly.
Need to know?
Well, it comes when you have to, you know, think about covers and things. And then you're like, oh my word, you actually have to have something in mind to you know, show the cover designers. This is what I'm thinking about. So yeah, and then you have editors who are, you know, a lot more descriptive in what they're looking for.
Right.
They want more description in your writing. And so you have to adjust. And I don't think people realize how much influence editors actually have on your writing. Because, you know, I can see which books are with which editors because there was such a difference in approach.
Yeah, it's really true. I think it's one of those things that writers that aren't in a traditional publishing system or never been in that system or are not yet published either independently or like how much your experience depends on that relationship, because it can be a great relationship and it makes your work better and it makes you a better author and it puts you in a better position. And if it's not good, I mean, it can really bust your soul up and really change the trajectory of your career. And I mean, it's something that is so completely out of our control when it's traditional, obviously. I mean, when you're independent, it's different, but I mean, you know, it feels like a crapshoot sometimes.
Yeah, you have no say in it. I mean, it kind of, well, yeah, it really just depends on what you get that, you know, with that particular book.
And that can be a really good experience too, right? I mean, like, do you feel like each of those editors added something to your, your writing?
Absolutely. I've had, I think I've learned something from every editor. I mean, the experiences have ranged. I mean, I've had good experiences. I've had, I've never had like a bad experience, but I've definitely had more challenging experiences where the vision for the book was just different. Yeah. So, you know, it's not necessarily that you have a disagreement in terms of personality, but your vision for the book is just different. So you
and then you have to find that middle ground.
Exactly. And negotiate. And sometimes, you know, you have to take a step back and figure out, you know, what is worth, what is it worth fighting? Is this particular thing worth fighting for, or is this thing worth fighting for? And it's just constantly I think just in general, traditional publishing is a conversation. You know, you're just constantly talking and trying to figure out, is this something that works for both of you?
Yeah, that's really true. And again, I think that's not something that we really talk about, you know what I mean? Like, it's just there. And I don't know how much we really, because that's the thing, right? I mean, sometimes you come in and it's like, this has to be this way because it means a lot to me, or it means a lot to the story, or you know, I mean, if you pull this thread out, it's going to unravel the entire thing, and it is worth fighting for. And there are some things that you come in and you think that it's amazing, and then the more that you work through the editorial process, the more you realize, like, oh, this would be better if it was changed.
Exactly.
And sometimes it's like, well, this isn't worth fighting about, and what I think is going to take a whole bunch of edits is like four lines scattered throughout, you know, a 200-page manuscript, and you're like, oh, never mind, it's fine, it's good now.
Exactly.
I thought that was going to be hard, and it's not hard. That wasn't hard. I just needed to add three lines. It's fine.
It's exactly that, and you don't know until you're actually working through it.
No.
So oftentimes, my responses to edit letters always, thank you so much. I completely get what you're going. I will contact you if while I'm doing this, I have an issue, because half the time, like, I cannot, you know, personally, the
you can't picture it until you're in it.
Cannot do this. It's not going to work at all. And then as you're going through it, you're like, oh, okay, I can just change this. And this
you realize how simple it is. You're like, oh, no, now it is better. It is better that way.
Exactly.
Never mind. It's fine. This is fine. Well, and I found too, I don't do it as much now, but when I was traditionally published, like, my very first reaction to any editorial letter was to just want to have an absolute meltdown, like a toddler level meltdown. I'm like, no, I don't want to change any of it. You're wrong. And so I would need to like get through that without responding in any way. And then I would read it again and be like, oh yeah, no, I can do this. But like, my first response was so bristly of like,
exactly,
no, I don't want to change anything.
I think for me, I kind of had the opposite, but because when you do have an anxiety issue, you're always going in thinking, this is completely terrible, it's not going to work at all. So you're expecting them to tell you, this is completely terrible, you're going to scrap it. So whenever I get nice things,
we don't even want the money back, we just don't want to do this anymore.
Please.
There was always that too.
Exactly. So you get that, and you know, I mean, I've received many a compliment sandwich. I don't know if you know what that is.
Oh, I love the compliment sandwich. Do you want to tell listeners in case they've never had a compliment sandwich?
Yeah, so it's an editorial approach, basically, where they'll start with something good and then they'll give you sort of all the other things that you need to change, and they'll end with something good. So you're always feeling good when you're opening the letter, because they start and end with something good. And I don't think I would have known that if I didn't, because my background is in editing, my educational background as well. So that was one of the approaches they taught you. You know, you go through and you give them the compliment sandwich. So it's actually quite funny for me to get it. Right. I love it.
I know what you're doing.
Exactly.
Your tricks. I don't know if I learned the terminology for it. Someone must have told me because I don't have an editorial background, but I remember being like, oh, it's a compliment sandwich.
I think it's the, after a while, you're just like, okay, you're just the compliment sandwich.
I'm getting it. Yeah, no, every time I'm like, no, the compliment sandwich. All right. What do we have to change here?
Sometimes that sandwich is, that inside of that sandwich is thick, eh? It's like,
it's terrible. It's a terrible sandwich. Yeah. But the bread is nice.
Yes, exactly.
So that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but do you feel like as you've gone along over the last 6 years that has become an easier process too? Like that like you said, like at the beginning, you're like, oh, they're going to just take the money back. I'm going to be out of a job. But you know, the more that you get used to that process, do you feel like that has become easier?
Oh, I mean, that's such a hard question. Because
sometimes,
I think the process is much easier now. So I know what's coming. I know I'm going to get this letter. I know that it's going to look this way. I know what the expectations of me are. But with each new editor that I get, you kind of have to figure out whether or not you have to figure out how that is going. You don't know initially. Right. You don't know how that's going
to be. Yeah, I'd forgotten you've gone through so many editors. So yeah, then it's like reset every time.
Exactly. And so my Harlequin editor, who I've been with for the longest, it's much easier with her because I know what she's looking for and I know when she says something, this is what she means. So we've established that relationship. When I've signed with my more recent publishers, they've all been wonderful and they really have been very good at meeting me where I am. So you know, my experience in publishing, even though I've been in publishing for a while, it has been very different, I think, to a lot of authors because I'm outside of mainstream publishing in that sense of just based on where I live. I've had a lot of, you know, conversations where I'm like, I actually don't know what this means, or I don't know where in the process this is. Can you explain that to me? And they've been really good with that. In the same way, they've done that with editing as well, where they'll be like, okay, this is what we mean. I think a lot of what I've encountered in that sense is, like language, like something simple, like the Z versus the S, like in Americanisms and UK English. Exactly.
So, and we have like every culture has idioms, right? Like I said, I said one earlier that I'm like, oh, I wonder if that's like translates across culture. So, I mean, like if someone says something and it's just, we all know what it means in the United States, but like if you're from another country, you might be like, what? The same way that sometimes when I watch British television, I'm like, I don't understand any of those references at all. Like, I don't know what you're talking about, but you're funny.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's kind of parsing out, it's the same language, but the language is different.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But I think because American culture is so pervasive in all of the world.
Yeah, sorry about that. We're real dicks.
That we, you know, you've generally been exposed to quite a lot by the time you are necessarily working with American people. Right. So it's not that much of a surprise, but I find the reverse true, right? So I will say something and sometimes that's not understood because it's not like South African, you know, culture is something that's...
Right, pervasive to where
you're in America, or exactly. So I think something simple as I was writing, she was singing false, because I mean it sounds silly now, but she sang false in karaoke, and my editor was like, I don't know what this means, and I did it a couple of times, and she kept saying, I don't understand, like, what does this mean? And I realized, oh, this is not something that is said anywhere else in the world.
Although from the context, it doesn't seem like it means that she was singing off key, right? Is that what
exactly?
You're...
Yeah.
Context. Come on. But it's not a term that in the
exactly.
That yeah, and that's interesting.
You get readers who aren't really open to learning context, and that's the reality of it. Yeah, I mean, it is sad because as a non-American or a non-British person, you very quickly learn to, you know, Google or do a search because, and I mean, it's not even something you think about. It's like, oh, I don't understand this reference. Let me just, you know, do an internet search on it. Whereas there's very little tolerance when it's in the reverse. That's just been my experience.
And it's true. I mean, I think that we, especially Americans, are really culturally like, no, you know, I don't want to learn new things. And it makes me sad because, I mean, anytime, it isn't hard to Google. Like, it's right on your phone. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's like you even have to go to a computer now. Like, it's on your phone.
Yeah, and like, if you're reading an e-reader, you can, this is just like,
you highlight it.
Tap on it, exactly. And Wikipedia will come up and tell you things.
It will tell you. And I always find that really fun, you know, when I'm reading something that's different from something that I've read before, and then I go, oh, I don't know what that is, and I look it up. Like, that's kind of exciting to me to learn something new. Like, seeing false is that's a great way to put the concept of being off key.
Yeah.
Like, that's really cool. But I don't know. I guess, I mean, you know, I don't know if I know you're on Twitter, but Tessa Dare has been talking about that she's learning Portuguese because some of her books are translated into Portuguese.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she's been watching Big Brother in Portugal, I think, or like The Bachelor in Portugal.
Yes,
and so she's been tweeting in Portuguese as she's learning Portuguese.
Exactly.
And there's like this really weird backlash from people where they're like, how dare you tweet in another language? She's like, well, you can mute the hashtag if you don't want to see it. But like,
I know.
It's like, yeah, this is the problem of
that's so strange. It's very strange to me because obviously I'm outside of that. So a lot of pop culture and a lot of just in, you know, culture in general is I'm outside of in that sense.
Yeah.
So and a lot of my peers are. So if we had that same attitude, we would not be understanding a good solid portion of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's just so part of our lives to see.
And yet we refuse to make it part of ours. And that's a real
and,
failing.
I mean, which is fine because I think just American culture doesn't require that of you. You don't have to learn about other cultures to be able to live your life
to function, right?
Exactly. And for us, it's very, you know, necessary.
It's so pervasive, yeah.
Exactly. We have to learn about American culture. Everything that happens in America, or you know, and a lot of what happens in the UK and stuff, eventually trickles down to us, or in some indirect way affects us. So, yeah, it's part of our lives, and I'd love, and I mean, I think I do see the shift happening now where people are becoming more aware that, you know, there isn't one
other places
culture.
Exist.
Exactly.
We're not the only ones, guys. Well, that leads to an interesting question because how did you start reading romance? Were you reading romance? I assume you grew up in South Africa.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you reading South African romance or were you reading the invader of like English and American and British romances?
I started reading was very young. And I read pretty indiscriminately then. And when you turn 13, libraries allow you to go into the adult section. So it's this amazing new world. And I am so excited. I was so excited. And I was like,
yeah.
And back then, the romance fixes I was getting was like Nancy Drew and Ned. And like just hoping that, you know, they get together, which is obviously very tame.
Yeah.
And I think really my idea of it started with like the Sweet Valley books, the series.
Yes, I loved those.
That was exactly, I mean, that was awesome. And eventually I had a cousin who slipped me a Mills and Boone or a Harlequin book. And once I read that first one, it was kind of like, okay, this
it's like a whole new world.
Exactly.
You're and not hoping that they'll get together. The point is that they're gonna get
exactly.
together.
Exactly. And it was this fact that all of the things that I was reading, what I loved most was, you know, this romance. And then I realized, oh my word, there's an entire genre dedicated to this completely. And it just opened such a huge world for me.
Yeah.
But there was no sort of African romance in that sense.
Yeah.
So
were you reading mostly most of Mills and Boone mostly then?
Yes, Mills and Boone. There were obviously the US trade books. I'm not sure if that's the right term. But I mean, the Nora Roberts. you know, those
early
stuff, like Silhouette was still a thing, so we had a lot of those books. And
because Harlequin had such a distribution system,
yes,
even when they were split up, Harlequin, Silhouette, Mills and Boone, like, because they were subscription, like, it felt like they were much more worldwide. I mean, they still are really good at selling all those foreign rights. So I mean, it does seem like they were the first touch for a lot of people who weren't living in the United States or living in the UK.
Definitely. And there were just so many of those books comparatively. I mean, I started out going to a very small library in my neighborhood. So if there was a series, there'd be like book one and then book like five.
Oh no.
Exactly, because most of our libraries rely on donations. We don't have a system where we can ask for, request that books be ordered, or we don't have an ebook lending system. So a lot of those structures were just not there for us. So we just, you go and you just read, and you read out of order, or you hope that they have a book that's in the same series. And then when I got older, my mom took me to a different library, which was the biggest one in our town. And they had a lot more, but still it was very limited. Getting an e-reader was just genuinely just opened so many doors for me, because
I can imagine.
I was finally like, oh my word. And it wasn't restricted. So I didn't have to, jump through hoops to get it because I was African or South African, which is, something that happens as well. It's like, oh, this book is not available in your territory, or it's not here, it's not in bookstores yet, or we're only getting it like 4, 5, 6 months after the release date. So that's just the reality we live in.
Yeah.
So to have an e-reader where you can just be like, oh my word, I can get this. Exactly. Exactly. For the most part, it was reasonably priced.
Do you see more people in South Africa reading e-readers because of that? Has the e-book revolution sort of taken over there more, or from what you see? Obviously, you can't speak to everyone's experience, but
I think in the more affluent community, definitely. So I wouldn't even say I think middle class and up, but because majority of our country isn't necessarily there, it's not obviously as big. But I think with phones, because a majority of our country has phones, so that's definitely made a difference. So you have access to things by downloading the app on your phone and being able to read. So that's definitely made a difference, I think.
I love that so many of those borders come down now, that we really become a more global community. And, speaking of Americans just only understanding their own culture, but the fact is we are a global community, and I want to see more of that global community, because we have so much more access to each other now because of phones and internet and e-readers and all that stuff. To me is like the most exciting part. Like, I want to be in a global world. I don't want to be in a
but that's one-way exactly world. It's like, for me, being part of the Twitter community is great, because I can just be there. It's this place, this platform where no one's, I mean, obviously unless we're talking about specific issues, but no one is saying being exclusive, because this belongs to everyone. This platform is everyone. So, I mean, one of the best things that happened was like someone DM'd me and was like, oh, we're going to talk about, romance. Do you want to come and have coffee? And they named like this New York coffee shop. And I was like, I would love to.
But yes, please. Going to be kind of a commute, but sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, like, because they don't even realize that you're not from, which I guess there's benefits to that, and that like, you're just Therese, and that's great. But then at the same time, then they invite you to coffee in New York, and
that's which is really sad.
It was nice.
I'd love to. Exactly. Sorry, but just to go back to your earlier question about the romance, the South African romance, there wasn't much. And certainly not in our libraries, I think, which is where I was getting majority of my books. I remember once reading a Mills and Boone that was set in South Africa. I don't think the person who wrote it, I can't remember, but I don't think that person was South African. But I just remember feeling so happy that I saw this place that I lived in, and I had never been to the place. I just obviously recognized the name. I didn't know if it was an accurate portrayal. I was just so
But still,
happy.
there's like representation there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's exactly that, and that's why I think the majority of my books are set from in South Africa. And all of my characters are South African. I'm trying to think. I don't think I've written someone who's not or doesn't at least have a South African tie. In terms of heritage, because I just didn't see that. So for me, it's a privilege to write that. For me, it's
I
such an
love that.
amazing thing that I can do that because I didn't see it growing up. Didn't see diverse books growing up. In fact, I think I was writing already when I started realizing, oh, okay, look, there's this entire community. I just haven't been exposed to it.
Yeah.
So, and that's unfortunately like the reality of living in a place where you don't see those type of things. I mean, we do have our publishing industry here is very focused on nonfiction,
Yeah.
and the fiction is generally either crime, it's generally written by white males, because I think, and I mean,
No
I
one can see my
all.
face but you, but I made the face. We know the face I just
And I do, there's definitely a shift post 1994, actually becoming a democracy and all of
made.
that. There's definitely been a shift and a turn to more diverse literature because majority of our country is not white.
Yes.
So we definitely have more of that now, but still the content of what's written here, I don't think I mean, I'm not going to speak for the entire country and for the entire industry, but my perception of it is a lot is that we are not allowed to be just free and sort of this happy-go-lucky that like romance, something that's lighter, that's fun and just completely focused on the joy of it. A lot of our fiction has got this really heavy atmosphere of struggle, or it's set in the past, it's set during our apartheid, during that time of segregation.
Yeah.
So and then obviously we're still feeling that effects now, 30 odd year 30 I think it's about I just and the math is not my strong point, so I'm not gonna say that. I think it's about just
No, decades later, yeah, it's still,
decades, exactly.
yeah.
Yes, yeah, so that's much a better way of saying it.
We'll fudge it. It was decades later. Yeah. But I mean, it seems like that is something that I've spoken to many authors and especially Black authors about, is that there's this expectation of there has to be a struggle for it to be, and that being able to write romance where it's just joyful, like it's the joy of two people or more falling in love and being able to be happy together, and that the requirement isn't always to please cut your veins open and bleed is really positive. Do you feel the same way?
I do. And look, I will very readily say that once I started publishing in the US and the UK and having my stuff there, I stopped sort of doing as much research into South African publishing because I just felt like there was just not a space for the stories I wanted to tell. So, I mean, we had a romance-only publisher, but it was also very much, to cater to our Black audience in South Africa, and I fall between that year, right? So I'm not white, I'm not Black, according to the way we look at our racial structures here. So I'm between that because I'm mixed race. So it was also very, I was excluded from being able to pursue that because I wasn't a Black author, according to them. And we do have an incredibly big Afrikaans, which is one of our official languages, romance section of romance community. So I unfortunately do not have a very strong background in that language. So I also couldn't, write that. So it's, you know, you're in this in-between space. So while there are opportunities, perhaps it's just not, yeah, it's just you
It's not
kind
a
of fall
space that's
somewhere in between
expanded
it.
yet to,
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. And I think we'll get there eventually, but I mean, there's so much more, but there, you know, when you live in a country like ours where the priorities are much more basic in terms of just like water and sanitation and you know, those type of things where a good solid portion of our country just need their basic needs fulfilled. Something like the publishing industry, which is a privileged industry in that sense, is not going to be at the forefront of progression necessarily.
No, that makes sense. So I know that you mentioned before in some interviews and in your biography that you submitted for the So You Think You Can Write contest from Harlequin. And then the more that I read about that, it sounded like that was a, was that a South African specific writing contest?
No,
Okay. Then I
it was just
misunderstood.
open.
Just an open.
It was open. Well, I think it was open to the countries that Moles and Boone published in, so the
Okay.
English territories. And there was another thing, like there were so few of the international writing competitions that were open to South Africans.
Right.
So when I saw this, I was like, oh my goodness, this is an opportunity for me
Yeah.
to finally do this. I always wanted to be a writer. I always wanted to be a romance writer. So I knew Mills and Boon and Harlequin quite well at that point. So when I came across this competition, I was still at university and I thought, okay, let me, you know, let me try. I was terrified of having to go look for a job. You know, and we were also raised, I don't know, I think that's probably something that happens in America as well, but you know, the arts and cult, you know, artistic careers are not like you the first thing that you should pursue. It's always the backup. So yeah, like my mom was and my parents were always like, okay, you can drive, but what's going to be your first
What's going to be the
career?
real job, the quote unquote real job?
Exactly, exactly. And I just thought, oh, you know, if I can prove to myself and to them that I can actually write a book and that I can do it, then this might actually work out. Obviously, not knowing at that stage what I was going in or what I was getting into in terms of, you know, how much I was going to be paid, how much I was going to be required to write. I didn't know about agents. I didn't know, really, I knew very little about the
Sounds like you
publishing
just ran up
industry.
to a cliff and just jumped off and went, I'm gonna see how this goes.
I recognized Moles and Boone. I recognized Harlequin. I knew I wanted to write romance. I loved category romance. And I was like, that's enough for me right now. I'll figure out, you
We'll
know,
figure out the
when
rest
I
as we go.
exactly. So I entered the competition. Well, I first wrote and I was very happy because I just wanted to see if I could write at the beginning. I just wanted to know, could I write something from start to finish?
So you had you written anything before this, or you just kind of were like, I'm gonna write something and see how it goes, or?
But I never finished anything. I never wrote anything, not more than I don't even know words. I never used to count words. Everything used to be like two chapters. Never finished it. Never thought about things like character development or plot or whatever. And then I just wrote the book and I just told myself, I'm just going to write 50,000 words. I mean, they were terrible. They were awful words. But we just had to enter the first
Except put
chapter.
50,000 of them right next to each other and it'll do
Yes.
the
Exactly. I mean, that first book was so awful. There was kidnapping in it. This is romance,
Oh,
but
I
there
love
was
it.
kidnapping in it. There was a drug, like there was embezzlement, there was some drug
Good
issue.
Lord. Was
I
intrigue,
did
some intrigue.
everything I just pushed in there. I was just like, I'm just gonna make 50,000 words. But because the competition initially only required you to write one chapter and enter that chapter, and I mean, I sent that chapter to everyone. I was like, can you just tell me whether or not this is fine? Okay, obviously, everyone, my friends in that sort of place, and then I entered and editor liked it, and so I got through to the top 25, which is then when you send your full book in, and that book was a complete mess. So obviously, I didn't get further. But the following year, they had the competition again. And so I entered it again. And this time, because I actually got personalized feedback from the editor, and she was like, you have a great voice, but, you know, maybe read more books and maybe, you know, look into things like character development and plot.
So she kind of pointed you, the editor pointed you in a direction to sort of like things to work on.
Exactly, and she was very nice about it, and at that point I was just so happy to see that there was something in this, you know, and might not have been imperfect, but it was if someone could.
There's a kernel there that can be,
and someone who knew what they were talking about.
Yeah. Oh my god, isn't that the best? The first time you get that, where it's like, this is, you get, you know, you're good at this, but this is the right problem. Even when it's that no, you're like, I'm good at this.
I mean, it's like, I have a voice.
It's like magic. Somebody just performed magic. Yeah.
Exactly. So, so the next year, I did it. I entered again. I got into the next round again, but this time around, it relied on votes. So they had it completely on Wattpad. And I mean, I don't know that many people. I'm not American. So I asked literally everyone in my family, and I literally went down my contact list and I was like, can you please vote for me? It's awful to do. And then I didn't get any further. But the same editor read that book, and then she emailed me when the contest is done, and she was like, okay, listen, I think you have something here. Do you want to go forward with this and we can work on it together? Do you want to submit something new to me? Let's just talk. And that was obviously the most amazing thing that I've
you must ever- have just been over the moon.
I died. I was so happy. I had just gotten married. I was in a job that was awful. I hated it so much. I was, you know, crying in the bathroom at this job. Like, I'd go, you know, during lunchtime, just be like, okay, I'm
just going to cry my lunch in the bathroom.
Exactly. So to get this and for it to come at that time was just so amazing. And then I think about 6 or 7 months later, after working with her pretty consistently, and she was fast. I'd send her something like the weekend, and then the Wednesday of the next week, she'd be like, here's your feedback, da, 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 da. And she was a great, you know, first editor, because she literally went chapter by chapter with me. And so I was
able amazing. To,
I know. I mean, I love her so much. And eventually, you know, it was the day before my birthday, and she called me and she told me, look, they want to publish me. And it was really something. I mean, I cried, and I had people over for dinner, and I was like, oh my word, look. And it was so funny, because I didn't actually want to tell them, because I was so convinced that they were going to call me.
Right. Well, it's going to go, they're going to take it back. Exactly. Yeah. Right. It can't be real.
No, definitely not. I'm gonna wait until they send me the contract and I've signed it and I'll take it back. And then exactly.
Yeah, the entire time that I was traditionally published, I was like, at any moment they could take this away. Is it ever really real?
How long were you traditionally published for?
So I wrote for HarperCollins from 2000. They bought my first book in 2004. It came out in 2005. And then so I had books out from 2005 to 2011. Then I left HarperCollins. And then I wrote for Samhain from 2012 to 2004, through the end of 2014. And then I went fully indie. So I've been fully indie ever since. But so a good almost 10 years of traditionally publishing before I went and jumped ship and went indie.
10 years of wondering when they were going to be like, listen.
Yeah, when is the other shoe going to drop? Is this, when are they going to figure out that I'm not actually good at this?
It must be a refreshing change to have that entirely, you know, on you. It's completely your, sort of in your control now, whether or not you move forward in, you know, in a general sense. I'm not talking about like sales and whatever, but I mean, just to be able to know that.
What the pace is going to be, and I wonder, I mean, almost all of your books are traditionally published, right? Everything that I kind of could parse out looked like it was traditionally published. So have you ever considered doing indie, or is that?
I have. I've done it several times. I thought about it a lot. And then I think right before I fell pregnant last year, I was like, okay, maybe I should do this. Maybe I should look into this. Cause I think at that stage, I was writing category. I just sold to Karina Press. I just then signed with my agent, And before I had babies and before, you know, my life completely changed, I was writing at a pretty fast pace. So, which is necessary for category, right? If you want to, you know, you actually sort of keep up with
a lot of... They want you to in a different way that a non-category publisher kind of single, is like, well, every day, single title's like, well, every 9 months, every 12 months, it's fine. Exactly. And category's like, can you do 11 books a year? That'd be great.
I mean, they're very understanding sort of with life, but in general, like, the more you can write, the better it is
for your
name recognition.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a space for it. So you can write 4 to 6 books a year and tell them, look, I can write this. Is there space in the publishing schedule for me? And they can easily make that happen.
Yeah.
I think a year.
Which sets you up really well for indie, because speed is king.
But then, you know, just the entire process intimidates me so much.
Yeah, right, because you're in control of everything, happy face. You're in control of everything, sad face.
exactly. So it's something that you know, and also a lot of the things that you can do as an indie author, I think, shifts a little bit when you're not in the US and the UK.
That's true.
So a lot of the things that you do in terms of name recognition is not available to you, or, you know, you're doing it at, you're sitting at 3 a.m. in the morning, you know, visiting Facebook groups, or, you know, doing author takeovers, or you know,
right, and it has to be the math of, do I want to do that, is it worth doing that? That's the
and now it's not very feasible with having
with children. You mean they're not going to be like, sorry mom, no, you we're up till 4 in the morning visiting Facebook groups, so, but we still want to eat? That's crazy.
So but I definitely have, and I have a great support system in terms of that. So I do think that if I eventually get to
something
that,
you might dip your toe into again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just to see what it's like, you know, and but you also need to have capital in order to do that. And
true.
It's, you know, I always say this to people, but our currency and the dollars, you know, like 15 times but my one of 15 times my currency is one of your dollars. So it's very different in that, you know, sense. It's all of these things that you have to take into consideration before you actually pursue something like that.
Right. And it's really interesting because, again, it's not something that I think about, but I mean, it is another layer of consideration where it's like, okay, that's great, because you can make the money translates maybe to more money, but also the cost translates to higher costs.
Exactly.
So math problem.
It is. Yeah. And you kind of have to think of what is, you know, something simple. I think someone told me on Twitter, was like, oh, why don't you just buy this software, whatever? And then I said, well, the software would cost me actually like a month of groceries, because, you know, the we were having a particularly bad month that month, so our currency was incredibly weak, or, you know, there was some scandal that happened, which is, you know, something that often happens in our government, so we have to deal with that. And then, you know, our currency is super weak, and then we have, and I'm just like, I'm sorry, I can't invest in a software that's going to cost me the same as groceries, not right now at least, you know, maybe someday, but not right now.
Right. Yeah. It's a level, a different level of consideration that I think is probably very interesting to everyone who's listening, who is not in the United States or the UK. They're like, yes, please tell us more. It's true. So I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking about your process just a little bit, because I know a lot of the listeners that are writers, they always like to hear about how people do things. So are you kind of a plotter? Are you a pantser? Are you something in the middle?
Well, I'm a pantser in terms of every event that happens. The only thing I have planned out before is the emotional arcs. And that's generally because, you know, I once worked with an editor and I would say, I don't know what's going to happen. This is the idea I have. This is the tropes that I am thinking about. And she said, okay, I completely understand that, but let's try and think about emotional arcs so that when we get there, we have that sorted out, you know, so that we can at least, I can, you know, say, this is where the character starts and this is where the character ends. And that's been incredibly helpful to me, because that's how I pitch now. That's, you know, when I'm writing later is when I start the book. That's what I do. I generally start out with tropes when I'm thinking about a book.
Mm-hmm.
Often, you know, we'll get from our editors at Harlequin, we'll have a meeting and they'll be like, you know what, we're looking for more friends, the lovers, or billionaires are doing really well, or, you know, this is the type of trope that we're doing. And so I'll try and see if I have any stories in my head that align with those tropes. And I think, you know, what can I do with it that's new, that's different? I love, you know, playing with power dynamics. So if we have a Beauty and the Beast, I'll be like, okay, so let's do a Beauty and the Beast, but she'll be the Beast, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, so
or we'll have a, you know, a work romance or an office romance, but she'll be the boss and stuff like mm-hmm. that. I love that. So I'll start with that, and then I'll kind of write a very brief outline. I'll be like, okay, she gets to, this is what they want together. And then I'll be like, but this is the emotional arc, and I'll send that off. Internal conflict, external conflict, resolution, send that off to my editor, get their opinion. And then after that, I start. I generally have a really good idea of where I want the book to start. So I always mm-hmm. have an opening scene. And that's always fun. The first chapters for me are always the best chapters to write, because, you know, you don't have to think about any of the, well, not initially, you don't think about like, oh, okay, how is this going to develop? What is she going to do? What is he going to do? What are they going to do to, you know, show that they've been hurt in the past? You can just kind of start and just be creative. And then from there, I just hope and pray that I have something to write during the day.
Right.
That I have an idea.
Do you do character sheets or anything like that? Or it's just kind of like, here's the arc and let's go and I'll figure it out as I go.
No, I mean, I'll do it. I'll
pure,
do the
extra, pure pansy, really.
Exactly. I'll do the conflicts for each character, but
yeah.
Also that, like,
it's guideposts, but not a map. Mm-hmm.
No yeah. way. I kind of just hope I get to the destination I'm hoping to get to.
So that's very interesting to me, because I know that you wrote a series for Karina called One Day to Forever, which features three books told over mm-hmm. the 24-hour period and at the same yep. wedding, which yes. I have done books where secondary characters in book one have a romance that's clearly happening in the background, and then book two is that romance where, and then they overlay, but you kind of get some cheat-y like kind of scenes where it's like, this is the scene between these two characters, now it's from this character's point of view, which I love because it's free words, and then it's really fun to see like what what did they see from their point of view in this same scene, what were their goals in this point of view and this in their point of view. But I mean, that is a challenge. And so I mean, I guess hearing that you don't plot it, like that must have been a real challenge, like kind of keeping track of where everybody was and what, you know, how you were laying in those other characters. And
so, well, I mean, they don't take place at the same wedding. So
it's a different wedding.
It's one, the first book is a wedding. So it's three standalone books.
I got it.
Right. And it's sisters. Each book takes place over 24 hours. And
but it's not the same 24 hours.
Not the same.
Oh, thank God. Because I was like, oh my God, how did you keep track of all that?
I was stressed listening to you.
You would just, your head would explode.
I was stressed. Yeah. No, because I did a book. The third book in that series takes place in past and present. So we have 24 hours. So the present book, the present timeline is over 24 hours. And then the past, the first half of the book is one 24 hours, one set of 24 hours. And the second book is like several 24 hours. I know it sounds so complicated, but you know, writing that book really made my head explode, because I was like, why are you doing this?
Why am I challenging myself this way?
It's terrible, because I mean, and I always try with that book, I worked so hard in it because I was trying to make the past and the present align in terms of tropes, in terms of emotional development. So when you see something in the present happening, because it's a second chance romance, where, you know, they are struggling with this decision that they made, and then the past will see them actually going through that decision. So there was so much balance, you know, so much to consider when you're trying to balance it. And I mean, I created my editor with that, because I told them, I was like, listen, this is the idea I have. I don't have any plan. This is just kind of what I'm thinking the book is going to look like. are you okay? And they were like, yes, please do it. And I mean, you know, it's not always, that doesn't always happen where you just get completely bleeding and you just, you know, you can say, listen, this book is going to be very messy, structured.
There's this crazy pants idea. It's going to be a mess. Is that cool?
And I can't give you a plan. I can't give you a plan. I'm not going to give you the book until it's done. So how do you feel about that? And I was just really lucky to have an editor who was like, yes, please do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause that's, I think that's a lot harder sell in a traditional, like, you know, as you can just be like, yeah, I'm going to do this crazy dance thing and see if it works, but it's a lot harder.
I mean, even the 24 hour ideas, the first it started out as a novella and I was like, yeah, 24 hours is fine to do like over 50,000 words, you know, and a wedding, that's fun, and Christmas, that's fine.
Perfect.
And when I started submitting the book, and a publisher came back and was like, listen, we love the book, but it's 30,000 words, we can't sell the, you know, would you be interested in making it 50,000 words? And I was like, sure. And I
now you're like,
uh-oh. Yeah, 24 like, hours. Oh, okay. No, exactly. And I was very cognizant of myself not believing in instant love, and I was like, oh, how are you gonna do this, because you're saying you know, like, relationships aren't just like bam, well, this is my perception of it, right? Like, my I'm very realistic in real life, and I'm like, oh, people don't fall in love in one day. I'm like, and then when I have my author hat, and I'm like, this is completely possible, people do, and I believe in everything,
that love is real. Exactly. Yeah, no, it's so funny how I would, if someone was like, I met this guy and in 24 hours I married him, I'd be like, oh my god, don't do it, you're gonna get murdered.
Exactly.
But in book world, I'm like, this is so romantic.
I think I tweeted once about, like, if my friend was like, listen, I have this guy, I remember all those things he did to me, but we have a second chance now, and I'd be like, please do not go down that path again.
That's crazy.
And then half of my books, I'm reading like 50 to 60% of my books are second chance romances. So I'm like, what are you doing? Anyway, you know, we are hypocritical. I fully.
But tropes are fans, like, tropes are different than real life. Like, I mean, it's the same thing of like, oh, there's only one bed. Like, what would really happen in real life? Like, everyone would scoot to the edge. There'd be a pillow in the middle. Everybody would just sleep because they're trapped in a storm and you'd just be stressed out about the rain breaking the like the branch and killing us all. Like, that's what you would be doing in real life. But in romance life, it's different.
You have to curl up together for heat purposes.
Cold body heat is the only way you're going to survive. Whatever, we're allowed. Exactly. We're allowed some liberty. I mean,
exactly. I mean, I've stated, I don't think I've ever like told someone, oh no, but this is true, I really believe this is happening. I'm fully you know, realistic about how hypocritical I am.
I know, though. I mean, like, that's part of the fantasy, you know, that's part of the setup, you know, I mean, these, because I do believe that love is real, and I do believe that romance is real and all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, like, would I as a human ever do some of the things that I've written? No, of course not. That's silly. but
that's exactly whatever. It's like, but I mean, even in those books, I there was never a, you know, we are going to go get married. It was always like, we really like one another. We have this connection. Let's see where this goes. Except for the last book, which is they were actually married. So it's like,
yeah, okay, easier.
We need to figure out it's this easier. Mess. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, and then when I got to 50,000 words with that first book, I started submitting it to other publishers as well. And Karina Pace came back and they were like, can you turn this into something that's like 70,000 words? I was like, okay.
I don't know, I guess so. I did this once, we're doing it again.
I'll just add another 20,000 words.
It's fine, I'll just find those somewhere. Maybe I can just add a lot of that. Could I add the word that a lot?
it's so funny
when you're like, oh, I need to add 10,000 words, where I'm going to find those? I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so much easier to start off worth knowing, okay, you at least need 70,000 words, but yeah, I was changing something and expanding it. So I'm
where
actually,
where can I fit a scene, and how does that screw up all the other scenes that I've written?
Exactly.
Well, how do I get into that scene and then exit that scene, and how does that scene affect all the other scenes? Now I have to write those scenes, rewrite those scenes.
So, oh my complicated. God,
people don't understand.
So they do not. They don't. So
it's making me anxious, like right now talking. Because I have done that, where I was like, oh no, dumb
to ask. Why did you do this to ourselves?
Why did I do this? Why didn't I just know that I should do this while I was writing it? Oh my God.
Books 2 and 3 were a little bit easier in that sense.
Because you knew that they were going to be, because they were bought, right? So it was like, you knew yes. they were going to be 70,000 words at that point. So then
I mean, yeah, and I think that. One ended up being like 85,000 or something like that. Like something long, much longer. Yeah. And I was like, wow. I mean, somehow I don't. But I mean, it's easier. So right. I'm coming from category where, you know, your focus is completely on the main couple and the penetration mm-hmm. of their dominance, and it's very tightly plotted and, you know, emotionally heavy. Whereas with these books, I could then be like, okay, so now we can have an uncle who does extended and we can have
a secondary characters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we can actually focus on them. And so it was really an awesome experience to actually be able to write about sisters and to write, you know, to explore a complicated relationship. Because I mean, generally, we don't really see that in romance. I don't know. I don't know if you maybe have, but sister relationships are not always focused on,
yeah.
especially complicated sister relationships. So I'm not talking about like women's fiction. I'm actually talking about like in romance itself.
Right.
You know, we have great brother relationships, and we have, you know, series that are based on that, but very rarely is it based on siblings who aren't a male. So for me, and because I have sisters, I was just like, this is not, you know, oh, we're best friends or we hate each other. There's somewhere, there's something in between.
Right, there's layers.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's like, let's you know, figure out, you know, sometimes we hate one another and sometimes we love one another. And sometimes you have to take responsibility for this parent and sometimes you don't. And, you know, this particular thing is your strength, and to figure out how that dynamic works. And that was really fun for me to actually be able to dive in and actually explore, because I now had the words and
no, you had wider edges so you can exactly. you could explore at a different depth that you would.
I'm sorry, I realize now I'm saying exactly so many times. No, which is of course right. something you realize when you
I when say you, a lot, like when I edit these things, I always find like, here's my word for the day. Like today I was obsessed with like.
That's awesome.
That all right, so it's fine. It's a conversation. That's how people talk. But crazily, incredibly, like our hour has just like flown by. Do you want to tell everyone what your latest book or your next book is or where they can find that?
Yes, I have 2 books coming out this year. The next one will be, it's called Awakened by the CEO's Kiss, which is a twist on the amnesia trope, and also the working together trope, like we were talking about. So we have a very, you know, confused man coming, filling in for his sister at her job, and discovering that her employer is actually a woman he's had a connection with and had a couple of dates with, and she's now... she does not seem to remember him. And because he's actually, you know, doing something for his sister and he doesn't want to rock the boat too much, he goes along with it. And then he eventually realizes, oh, she really doesn't remember him. so it's, and she obviously doesn't know anything about this. So it's a twist on that kind of.
I love that. That's a really cool setup.
Thank you. Thanks. And then I have my first trade paperback coming out at the end of this year with Kensington, called And They Lived Happily Ever After, which is about a romance author who dreams herself into her books. So she shares a kiss with someone in real life and discovers that he's now part of her books as well. So part of a dream. So it's a little bit complicated. But
yeah, no, I loved that idea. When I looked at it, that concept is just so high concept and so cool. So I'm really excited to see
Thank you. I mean, I'm very nervous. It's contemporary with some paranormal.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even want to call it that. I'm like, it's got a little bit of magic sprinkled onto it. That's yeah. kind of how I've been describing it. Because it's, I don't know if you know, the early, terrible to just, you know, compare yourself to Nora Roberts. I'm not, but the kind of early Nora Roberts where, yeah. you know, there would just be a whiff of like a ghost somewhere.
Right. Or, it's not like full on paranormal. That's the driving
exactly.
part.
But and very,
that she can dream little, this and it becomes
exactly
like is... it's just a little bit of magic and it's such a cool
bit.
Idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank and as you. I mean, you know, as a romance writer, I'm always like, oh, it's a romance writer. That's me.
Oh man. I don't know. I have such an obsession with romance. I actually listened to one of your podcasts where you talk about writing writers. I think you wrote an erotic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, one of the heroines was the writer, and then the hero was her editor, but he doesn't know that she's the writer. She's an anonymous historical, like, she's historical, so she's anonymous. So he doesn't know that it's her. Oh my god, I loved writing it so much. It was just ridiculous.
And it's so cool because you could, like, put in throwaway lines about the publishing industry or, like, about...
See, mine was historical, so it wasn't exactly the same, but oh my god, if it was contemporary, I would have been throwing shade left and right. Like, left and right.
I kept waiting for my editors to be like, listen.
Hey!
What are you saying here? But it was cool because I could also, she's also South African, the character, and so I could actually write about my experiences, and I hope people read it so that they can actually see that, you know, being a South African romance author is not the same experience as being a US or UK romance author. So,
well, I'm just really excited we got to dive into that a little bit more today. I think that that's going to be really interesting, to people who listen to this night. I mean, I really, really appreciate you coming by today.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, I don't do this video often, so for me to actually have a conversation with someone and to have a conversation about romance is so awesome. Thank you so much for asking me, Jess.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.